This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Roddinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us at our favorite hangout, doing our favorite thing, talking a little politics. Brandon, lots going on around the world. Let's kind of go outside in, starting with the world at large. Huge developments globally. The Iran deal is finally dead. What happened?
It's dead, at least in the U.S. sense, it's dead, right? This was a deal where Iran agreed to limit its creation of nuclear fuel and presumably was going to reduce their footprint in terms of their interactions with the rest of the country on nuclear weaponry. The president of the United States would agree to waive the sanctions which had been put into place at that time. The president called this the worst deal ever, promised to tear it up on the first day in office. Took him about a year, but he basically tore it up, right?
Yeah, exactly. So there's sort of two things here. One, you've got a situation where the president's argument is essentially that the deal wasn't comprehensive enough. While it dealt with nuclear-related weapons, it didn't deal with Iran as a sort of a regional threat and a state sponsor of terror. But even aside from that, the president questioned whether or not Iran was in compliance. Now, the independent assessment has always been that Iran has complied. Our allies, I think, for the most part, are pretty upset about this. They wanted the U.S. to stay in, and the EU and the members there are essentially saying, we're going to keep up with this, but you run the problem of potential sanctions, because under U.S. law, if you're dealing with Iran, you can't deal with the U.S., so it sets up this weird choice between working with the U.S. or working with Iran.
Yeah, this is a sharp break from Europe and the European allies. They had lobbied for weeks to get the president to stay in. He chose to ignore them. This is also, I think, a pretty profound America First moment, right? I mean, the president really is following through on what is, I think, a kind of domestic concern that this deal was not so good. I'm not sure that it's a bad deal. I mean, this is something obviously has to be thought through. But the fact that the president objected to it because it didn't go far enough or last long enough is one thing. But that seemed like something that the Iranians were willing to deal on. But now we don't know what's going to happen, right? The president has no real plan to have something in place. Essentially, the deal exists only in the context of the rest of the countries that were signers to this. So I'm not sure what they intend to have happen here. They presume it's going to put them in a better bargaining position. But I'm not sure that's right, because why would Iran bargain now? And why would anybody believe the U.S. would keep their deals?
Yeah, I agree. Well, speaking of keeping deals, where the president has gotten, I think, some criticism on Iran, he has gotten nothing but seeming praise with overtures to North Korea that have actually borne some fruit. We've got three Americans that were freed. We've got an announcement of a Trump-Kim summit on June 12th in Singapore. Lots going on here. Brandon, is this a big moment for Trump in terms of foreign policy?
I think this is his biggest win foreign policy-wise to date. I'd like to get your sense of this, but it seems to me that this is a good start towards the direction of having some kind of a bilateral relationship. I don't know if it's the case that the cause was because the president was more hawkish, but maybe that's part of it. Oddly enough, I think this takes away some of the leverage that North Korea had. Kim Jong-un had these individuals as a kind of ace in the hole and effectively gave it away. So is this really a gesture of goodwill, or are we going to get the kind of, James Bond movie version of a kind of spy pushback on this?
Yeah, I think that you've had prisoners in the past, Americans in the past that have been freed. So that's not entirely unprecedented. Dennis Rodman freed people. So I'm not sure that Mike
Pompeo... If the worm can do it.
Exactly, if the worm can do it, certainly Mike Pompeo and Donald Trump can. It's interesting to see what will come out of the summit. There's still a lot of work to be done. The big issue is, will North Korea actually engage in what we call denuclearization, where they essentially stop wanting to produce nuclear weapons and certainly being a sponsor potentially of selling them out? I think the Chinese played a big role in this, but it is a big win for the president. You've got the South Korean president, I think, has given him a lot of praise. There's talk of Donald Trump being a Nobel Peace Prize winner. So lots of things happening, but I do think it's a big win for the president.
Well, speaking of a win for the president, we should talk about the GOP primaries that happened, right? It's a bit of a mixed bag. I mean, I think on one hand, the fact that in West Virginia, Don Blankenship, who was somebody who had been in prison after some of his mines exploded that he owned and was convicted ultimately of conspiring to undermine mine safety regulations. He was, to put it mildly, a bad candidate. And Donald Trump tweeted out that people should not vote for him. So I guess that's a win. But what's the rest of the state of play in the primaries that happened last week?
Yeah, it's definitely a mixed bag. I think for the most part, you saw something interesting. Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine, a former U.S. senator, kind of beat back a pretty strong challenge from the current lieutenant governor, who was a Trump loyalist and was able to kind of win. And that was a huge win for kind of the moderate to conservative traditionalists in the Republican Party. In a similar vein, Democrats did really well in Ohio. They nominated Rob Corddry against Dennis Kucinich for that seat. Corddry, it was a one-time Republican, became a Democrat, very much a moderate centrist. So this is an interesting twist, because the expectation has been that the extremes of both parties would win. Mm-hmm. In this case, you had really two mainstream candidates setting up a really interesting Ohio race.
One alarm bell, though, for Democrats is that the Republicans outvoted them by a factor of almost 200,000 votes. Republicans were more interested, more active. I don't know if that suggests that this is something that statewide is likely to continue or nationwide is likely to continue, but that's one point of possible alarm. One positive point for Democrats all across the country for the states that held primaries was that women are still dominating. Of the 20 open Democratic House primaries with one woman on the ballot, voters selected the female nominee in 17 of them. So I think that you could definitely count on this as more clearly advantageous to the parties that have chosen women to be their nominees.
Well, shifting from the politics of out in the country to the politics of Washington, D.C., and Trump world, we've got Michael Cohen, the president's personal attorney, continues to unravel, and this story gets more and more bizarre, Brandon. What's happening?
Yeah. So Michael Cohen, this is the president's lawyer who was reputed to have paid off Stormy Daniels and the president had reimbursed him, apparently has ties to various companies and has been paid by various companies who have sought out his expertise, not necessarily because he's a good lawyer, but because of his proximity to Donald Trump. He said, and I quote, a couple of weeks ago, "I'm crushing it," to an associate. At this point, Jay, if this were like the last season of House of Cards, like, you wouldn't believe it. Like, it is too bizarre. These allegations come from Stormy Daniels' attorney, so they have to be kind of verified. But to me, the fact that there's this association and that some of Trump's associates are using their proximity to him to get rich is, I think, repugnant. And so it violates the sort of spirit that the president wanted to put into place, which was that he was going to drain the swamp and eliminate these kinds of conflicts of interest.
Well, there's two issues with Michael Cohen. One is that he's for all intents and purposes, was a lobbyist for corporations directly as it relates to Donald Trump. He had corporate backers in the form of AT&T and Novartis, the pharmaceutical company. Interestingly enough, both of them have pending issues, one in the case of opioids and the other in the case of a major merger they're trying to get cleared with Time Warner. You might recall during the campaign, AT&T and Donald Trump had a bit of a kerfuffle, so you can understand why they'd want to get in his good graces. But it sort of speaks to a question when Cohen himself is a person with very few clients, limited number of clients. He's sort of become this de facto agent for people to work through. Mm-hmm. And so that, again, raises some larger ethical questions. And we've got these issues related to Russian payments. Lots to unpack here. But I think the bottom line is that Trump, you know, the Russiagate investigation is going forward. And Michael Mickey Cohen might be in a lot of trouble.
Hey, also, it's an anniversary. This is the one-year anniversary of the week that that James Comey was fired. So we're kind of still digging, right? And that's going to continue. Well, moving from the Beltway to the Lone Star State here, we've got some interesting news on the race for the next Texas Speaker of the House. What's going on?
Yeah. Who is Eric Johnson and why is he running for Texas Speaker? Well, Eric Johnson is a Democratic state representative from the Dallas area. And you might be wondering, how possibly could he think he could be Texas Speaker? Well, he, as a practical matter, cannot. But what is he trying to accomplish with this, Brandon? Why is he trying to run when there's really no chance?
I think part of it is just a statement to say that the Democrats aren't just going to become pawns in the game of the Republicans are playing. I think that he also wants to make it clear that some of the antics that the Republicans have been up to won't be accepted and that the Democrats are going to push back. So if this is a hint or a signal of what's going to happen in the legislative session, I think we're going to see a lot more fireworks. But like you say, ultimately, it would be I think, an earth-shattering change to have a party to have the chamber choose somebody not of the majority party. So at this point, he's simply fishing with no bait.
Yeah, I think for this is much more about internal Democratic politics within the House. Eric Johnson is not a sort of a member of leadership in the Texas House on the Democratic side. No one's going to confuse him with someone like Rafael Anchia. But I think this is an opportunity for him to try to raise his stature vis-a-vis his peers on the Democratic side, maybe put himself in a position to do more. Once you start seeing Democrats being more successful, you might see some changes. And so Eric Johnson, I think, is trying to lay a predicate for himself as someone to watch moving forward.
Yeah. Well, speaking of watching out, there's been some unusual developments over a military training exercise, Jade Helm, which had risen to almost conspiratorial heights. And Michael Hayden, the former director of the CIA and NSA, is implied that, in fact, it might have been Russian bots or American alt-right media that has convinced Texans to believe that Jade Helm was some kind of a roundup of political dissidents. What's going on?
Yeah, not just average Texans, but the governor of Texas. So this was apparently a test run to see how Russian bots could influence public opinion.
It worked.
And it worked. It worked. The governor bought in. A lot of folks on the far right in, here in Texas bought in. And it's an embarrassment. But I think it sort of shows in general this weird little conspiratorial stuff coming out that Obama's going to go round up a bunch of weapons actually resonated with some populations and it carried over. And in some odd sort of way, it led to what we saw in 2016.
I think Republicans are just snake bit on this issue. Like, they are so slavishly committed to what the constituency perceptions are that they're afraid to go against it, right? So I think that this is part of the problem where you have such a core tight base of individuals who are committed to one way of doing things. And if you can get the ear of a particular person in power, then you can get things done. And so I think you're exactly right. This is embarrassing.
Speaking of embarrassing, Attorney General Ken Paxton filed a lawsuit along with six other states challenging the constitutionality of DACA. Well, he got some pretty strong pushback from the senior senator from Texas, Brandon. John Cornyn essentially is questioning the validity, and John Cornyn, a former attorney general, former Supreme Court justice, knows a thing or two about constitutionality.
Yeah, the senator said that he didn't understand what the state was asking for. It's surprising, actually. I mean, the fact that these are two Republicans who are disagreeing on strategy is one thing. But the fact that this is a pretty common play from the Republican playbook in Texas, and Cornyn didn't recognize that, is sort of interesting. To me, the reason is that Cornyn needs to play a neutral figure to try to broker a deal. He's still a majority whip until the end of this year. So he wants to be in a position where he can effectively try to make a deal happen if it happens to come to that point. He implied he thought the Supreme Court would have to work this out. Maybe that's true. But if it's not true, then Congress is still on the hook to have to solve this if possible.
Yeah, I mean, the irony of it is the lawsuit is essentially arguing for the Trump administration to do something that the Trump administration wants to do and is trying to do, which is end DACA. I think that's the point Cornyn's making. It's like, why are you telling us to do something that we know we want to do and the courts have already told us we can't do it? This is not a constructive use of time, money, resources, all of that. More to the point, it's just bad legal strategy. And I think that was Cornyn's point. Politics aside, it's an interesting play and a pretty strong level of criticism, you know, sort of Republican on Republican violence. Hey, let's shift gears locally. And we don't often do this, but let's talk about Houston. We got two kind of interesting things developing. Harris County is going to issue some bonds, pretty significant amount in the billions. Mm-hmm. We're not entirely sure what. But Harvey relief in terms of projects is on its way, Brandon.
Yeah. I thought one of the significant things you were going to say is that the Rockets are in the Western Conference Championship.
Yes.
So that was
well, you know, I'm
one.
Saving that for Houston when they wise. Are in the championship finals.
Good point, yeah. So this is interesting. Yeah, the election has been set for August 25th. This is sort of late summer, but by then people will be back, you know, going to school, and so everybody will be mostly back in the swing of things. We're talking about big numbers here, like you said, probably upwards of about $2.5 billion. So this is going to be a lot of projects. Low turnout is probably going to happen for an off-cycle election. That's pretty much guaranteed. But this is not like your average bond election. So I suspect you're going to see voters scrutinizing these projects pretty seriously because we could have things in there like, you know, a buyout of flooded properties, which is contentious, a new reservoir, widening of bayous. These projects could get some sympathy and some of them could get some scrutiny. So I don't know that this is a slam dunk in the way that a lot of bond elections are.
The interesting thing to me is scheduling this on the anniversary of Harvey itself,
yeah.
I think is a fascinating deal. They got special permission from the governor to have the election on August 25th, which I think will help depoliticize it to some extent. Mm-hmm. You're outside the partisan elements of Democrats and Republicans in the November election, but you do run the risk of election fatigue. We've had a lot of elections here in Texas over this period of time, so I'm not sure what turnout will be like. You'll only get the most committed voters, but at the end of the day, I think it's a net positive. It's something that we know has to be done. Well, speaking of drainage, we here in Houston are always looking for innovative ways to try and clean our drains, get water flowing out to the bayous. What do you think about the idea of maybe naming your drain?
I like it, actually.
Adopt a drain.
Adopt a drain. So this is a program that was designed to basically generate a little bit of money. Residents are supposed to adopt a storm drain. The problem is that it had been co-opted by a company that sells sex toys, and they had named a bunch of drains after this company. So it got to the point where we simply can't have nice things because people ruined it. But I did come up with some good drain names, Jay. What would be your preferred drain name?
You know, there's the obvious stuff like, Drano or, Water Be Gone.
Water Be Gone.
You know, all those sort of normal ones. What about you?
You would name it after yourself? Like that's...
yeah, exactly. Right? Exactly. Well, there's a famous one, the Bodie McBoatface, when you can name a boat contest that came about a few years ago. But yeah, what about you? What are your favorite
drain
names?
I came up with some good ones from presidents. Okay, so here they are. Drainald Trump. Okay. Ronald Drangan.
Oh, Lord.
Dwight Drain Eisenhower. Okay. Here's my favorite. Drainy Crockett. I'd be surprised if someone didn't take that. But
Drainy Crockett's a good one.
For our faithful listeners, steal it. Drainy Crockett.
Drainy Crockett. All right. Well, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, let's talk about, hey, we're going to have a debate. And it's going to be just moments away on the Democratic side for governor. What do we think about it? Is this really going to matter?
So, Jay, we've got one debate scheduled for the Democrats. We've got Andrew White, who is a businessman from Houston. We've got Lupe Valdez, who is the sheriff or was the sheriff from Dallas County. This is the one and only debate. We've got it on Friday night. It's going to be streamed only, not on broadcast. What do you expect in terms of what we should think about in terms of this debate?
I'm not sure what to expect because I think the rules are going to be pretty tight. We know that Valdez was really pushing back against wanting to do any debates, both from a perspective of, she's really the front runner in the race based on her earlier performance and sort of the structural advantage she had. And then the second part is she's just not proven herself to be very good in this type of environment. The more issue-oriented opportunity she's had, she's flubbed, whether it's on Texas Tribune or losing out on endorsements across the state at most newspapers. Anytime she's been confronted, she's had a very difficult time handling issues. And so I understand that. Andrew White, I think, really needs to be careful in some ways because the expectation for him is he's going to have to come at her. He wants to win the debate. What I would suggest for him is to lay out his plans, be really detail-oriented, and make the argument that the only way you're going to beat Greg Abbott is to be an idea-oriented candidate and a candidate based on sort of putting out policy positions. And that he's a better candidate for because otherwise attacking her, I think works against him.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. She has not performed well in many of these circumstances. I think though that to some degree plays to her advantage because the expectations are really low. If she can come out,
they're very low.
Yeah, if she can come out and be credible and hold her own through what I think was kind of personal messaging, right, telling her story, I think that gets her the win, because then people like are satisfied that she can handle it. Now, can she? I don't know, right? With repeated interactions, you know, you're going to see more. But with this one-shot deal, it's a high-profile moment. I think expectations are low, and she has to be able to meet them. I think for him, he's got to put all his wood behind one arrow. I mean, he has got to say he is the candidate who can beat Greg Abbott. And there are reasons for this, right? One is that, like we just had coming out very soon here, very recently, is that Greg Abbott had purchased a website and had stuffed it full of things about how Lupe Valdez is too liberal for Texas, right? Following the kind of Ted Cruz playbook, right? So if White can use this to his advantage by saying Abbott wants to run against her because she's a worse candidate and is too liberal, you should pick me, I think that's a credible case.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very credible case. I think the issue, we talked about the website. I mean, there's no doubt Governor Abbott is trying to put his thumb on the scale in favor of Lupe Valdez. Yeah. He wants to run against her. You know, we've seen this playbook before. I mean, Harry Reid famously in the U.S. Senate race for re-election did that years ago and sort of helped and backed a conservative challenger that was unelectable. Claire McCaskill in Missouri did this a few years ago and supported a guy named Todd Akin, who was a congressman at the time, to run against her for the same exact reason. You pick a weaker opponent. And I think there's no doubt, at least from a strategic perspective, Lupe Valdez is, in the mind of Greg Abbott, a weaker opponent. So I agree with you. I think electability is a big key here. We've seen nationally that candidates on the Democratic side that overtly make that message have seen some advantage. But I think that the careful thing White has to say is he cannot couch electability in that I'm the white guy, so vote for me. Mm-hmm. That electability has to be on policy, has to be on positions, it has to be on ability to raise money, ability to bring different people together, a large coalition of people together. I think that those are all key important elements here. He has to do it in a way that doesn't, I think, talk down to Lupe Valdez.
I think that's a good point. I mean, you know, he was kind of present at the inception of the sort of moment where Democrats were still winning, right? And so he is, I think, of the political class that could claim that he knows how to win. And that's not an argument probably that's very sellable to most people. But if you think about the subtext of it, it suggests that Valdez doesn't know how to win and that, you know, White has got a plan. He's going to raise money. He can put out these kind of issue profiles, which she hasn't done in as much of a flourish. So I think that he can be detail-oriented like that and talk about the fact that he is of that kind of political class that knows how to win. I think ultimately it's going to come down to turnout. Now, runoffs are notoriously undervoted in, so it's unlikely you're going to find a lot of people come. But those who do come are going to be much more liberal than the kind of run-of-the-mill voters in a general or even potentially in a primary. To boot, you've also got these runoffs in Dallas and Houston and San Antonio that are pitting more conservative Democrats against more liberal Democrats. And in those cases, too, you're going to find, I think, more liberals coming to vote. If you throw in the fact that Lupe Valdez is going to energize Latinos and women who are surging in terms of turnout, especially that college-educated, you know, 30 to 45 age range, then I think you're going to see that he's got to be able to stop that tide. He's got to talk about electability, because I think she has those natural advantages that don't allow for him to necessarily win in a walk.
Well, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to tell you why this debate matters and what to expect Friday night.
So, Jay, the Democrats are going to take center stage on Friday night. Let's talk about what we think is going to happen and why we should care, what to watch for.
I think what to watch for is how well Lupe Valdez is sort of able to kind of dodge any potential problems. Is she able to kind of hold it together? Because right now, when she's had been confronted with these opportunities, it hasn't worked well. I think the other part is to see how well Andrew White actually does. Is how aggressive is he to sort of taking a message to her? At the end of the day, I'm not sure this individual debate is going to be dispositive of anything, in large part because the coverage is so low. So I think in many ways, Valdez wins before it even starts because it's not going to be seen by a whole lot of people. There may be some news coverage about it, but short of that, I think it's a win for her already.
I think the biggest question for White is going to be, you know, can he press her on details, right? Because I think her biggest vulnerability is that she doesn't apparently look the part, right? And she's flubbed in some of these big profile instances. So I think he's got to push her a little bit. And that, I think, in doing so, he can kind of trumpet his own policies, which are a little unusual in some cases, but do have the advantage of giving him a kind of entry. I think for her, she's got to be able to hold her own. She's got to be able to talk about her personal story. That's something that appeals to people. And we've talked a lot about identity politics in the Democratic Party, but that stuff typically works. And if you're talking about a narrow universe of people who are going to vote in a runoff, she's got to connect to them. And that's something that she's had a little trouble with as well. This is her moment to be able to solidify that.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Thanks to our executive producer, Don Geraci, to our web team, Giselle Bueno and Matt Prendergast, and to our graphics guru, Michelle Lamb. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the big deal, Holtzlander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.